from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
This is War News Radio.
I'm Emily Hager.
And I'm Hanzi Lo Wong.
This will be the first time that the Iraqi democracy will really be tested, perhaps, in transferring power peacefully from one party to another.
This week on War News Radio, On the Horizon, we take a look at the upcoming provincial elections in Iraq, with an eye to how the results may reshape the country's political landscape.
And we head down to Washington, D.C. for the presidential inauguration.
We also hear Iraqi and Afghan reactions to the election of Barack Obama.
And a refresher on the historic links between Iraq and Israel.
Finally, we find out how neighboring countries have shaped the conflict in Afghanistan.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Barack Obama was sworn in as the 44th President of the United States this week. In his inauguration speech, he promised a new approach to American policy in the Middle East.
To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
In particular, the president referenced his plans for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, two issues that featured strongly in his campaign.
We will begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan.
We'll have more on the inauguration later in the program.
On his first full day on the job, President Obama met with a team of military leaders and advisors to begin planning the American withdrawal from Iraq. Meanwhile, military commanders in Afghanistan have started mapping out the deployment of the 30,000 additional troops who are expected to be sent to the country in the coming months.
On his second day in office, President Obama signed an executive order to close Guantanamo Bay Detention Center within a year. The cases against all 245 detainees in the prison will be reviewed to determine whether they will be freed, prosecuted, or transferred to another detention facility. Obama also signed orders that limit harsh interrogation tactics used by the CIA and prohibit the agency from holding detainees in secret prisons overseas.
President Obama has also named George Mitchell as his Middle East envoy, and Richard Holbrooke will serve as the envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Both men are experienced in conflict resolution. Mitchell, a former Democratic majority leader, drafted a well-received report on the Israel-Palestine conflict and worked on the settlement of the Northern Ireland conflict under President Bill Clinton. Holbrooke has served as the American ambassador to the UN, and he was the primary architect of the Dayton Accords that ended the Bosnian War.
In Iraq, political leaders across the country have been targeted in a string of attacks as provincial elections approach. Late last week, a leading candidate from Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki's party was killed in southern Babo province. The southern region has seen fierce competition between Maliki's Dawa party and the other Shia party, the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq. In Mosul, a Sunni tribal leader who had an electoral coalition was killed by a suicide bomber, and a top Sunni candidate from the Iraqi Islamic Party was targeted in an attack in Baghdad. The candidate, Zayed al-Ani, escaped the blast, but four bystanders were killed and 10 others wounded.
Also this week, the Iraqi Electoral Commission said that it had disqualified about 30 candidates from participating in the provincial elections. Some had forged the required documents. Others were former Baathists or had been members of Saddam's security forces. The commission also raised questions about the education level of the candidates. At least 60 are under investigation for falsifying documents certifying their academic background. Iraqi law requires candidates to have completed high school. Some 20 million ballots, which include the names of the disqualified candidates, have already been printed. However, the commission chief assured voters that lists of those disqualified will be posted in the polling places, and that they will not be allowed to take office, even if they receive enough votes.
The U.S. military has obtained permission to open a new supply route into Afghanistan through Russia and Central Asia. The route will provide an important backup option for moving equipment and provisions into Afghanistan. Previously, most supplies for American and NATO forces had been brought in over land through Pakistan, but those supply routes have been closed several times in recent weeks. Conflicts between locals and security forces and Pakistani operations against militants in the area have prevented access to these routes for days at a time.
The Afghan Pajwak News Agency reported this week that upwards of 24 civilians were killed in a U.S.-led raid just north of Kabul. Afghan officials disputed the claim, maintaining that only militants were killed. A spokesman for American forces responded that the U.S. is investigating the report.
Also this week, Taliban militants in Pakistan's northwest tribal regions bombed five girls' schools. No casualties were reported. the Taliban opposes women's education and had ordered all girls' schools to shut down by January 15th. Schools in the region are currently out of session until February for winter break, and some will likely remain closed as a result of the continued Taliban threat.
President Obama is widely expected to reach out to NATO members in his push to increase troop levels in Afghanistan, but he may not get much help. Others in the alliance are reluctant to send more troops into the war zone, and some are determined to pull out entirely. The Canadian Defense Minister said this week that Canada would stick with its plans to withdraw its troops by 2011. Meanwhile, France's Defense Minister said that his country will not send any additional troops to Afghanistan.
All branches of the U.S. military met recruitment goals for 2008 for the first time in 4 years. The economy, improved security in Iraq, and new outreach efforts have all been credited for the increase. The new recruits are sorely needed. The military has been strained by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, with many units deploying repeatedly for long periods overseas. Both the Army and the Marines hope to increase their total number of active duty forces in coming years. About 33,000 American troops are currently deployed in Afghanistan, 142,000 in Iraq.
This is War News Radio. The world looked on this week as Barack Obama was sworn in as America's 44th president. Supporters from around the world traveled to Washington, D.C. to witness the historic occasion, looking forward to what they hope will be a new direction in American policy. War News Radio's Daniel Simmons traveled to Washington to soak in the sights, sounds, and thoughts of the more than 2 million people in attendance. Here's Dan.
On January 20th, just over 2 million supporters converged on Washington, D.C. to witness the inauguration of the nation's first African-American president, Barack Obama, whose campaign was driven by the promise of change and hope. Driving into the Capitol on Inauguration Day proved easier than expected, but trying to move within the city was every bit as hectic as promised. Many spent the night before the inauguration sleeping in their cars, on the streets, and in cramped apartments. Others stayed awake all night in front of the Capitol building, trying to stake out a good view of the ceremony. By 7 a.m. on Tuesday morning, the streets were choked with pedestrian traffic, with packed subway cars running continuously to the National Mall. 2 miles away from the spot where Obama would be sworn in, I stopped people in the subway station to find out why they'd come.
Are you headed to the inauguration?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's history, because I came all the way from Cleveland, Ohio.
Did you vote for Obama?
Nope.
No? Why are you here?
It's time for a change, even though I didn't vote for Obama.
Fair enough. What does that mean, a change? What kind of change?
I think a change in society. I think there's too much materialism, too much focus on capitalism. There's a disparity between the rich and the poor. And I think it's time that the field gets balanced.
There was an undeniable party atmosphere in the city, and it was tough to find anyone with anything bad to say about Obama. The people I spoke to were uniformly optimistic about the new presidency, but stressed the importance of personal responsibility and individual action in sustaining the excitement.
What do you think change means for an Obama administration?
Obama is just a man. He's going to do as much as he can do. The rest is up to us.
Cool. We all got to work together with him.
Yeah, work together for change.
Back on the streets, the Obama zeitgeist was in full form. Vendors were peddling every imaginable Obama-themed item, and preachers on the street corner were offering their own support for the soon-to-be president.
History! History! Laminated!
Barack Obama action figures! Barack Obama action figures!
The crowds on the mall stretched from the steps of the Capitol building to the Lincoln Memorial, a sea of winter coats and American flags. All eyes were on the stage of the swearing-in ceremony. But before Obama took the stage, President Bush received a pointed farewell from the crowd. Finally, all the waiting was over.
To preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
The crowd thinned out shortly after Obama's speech. As former President Bush's helicopter hovered noisily overhead, an elderly man in military fatigues approached me and asked to share his thoughts.
Well, my name is Johnny Buchanan. I'm from Daleville, Alabama, and I'm a veteran and I'm a civil servant and I've been working for the government in uniform and out for the last 29 years. I'm afraid for the veterans. I'm a disabled veteran myself, and in my mind that once the veterans come back home, that they will be forgotten. So sometimes it makes me very, very sad.
Can you go on?
Yes, I'm a disabled veteran, and my disability was reduced. And I'm not sad on my account because I'm a civil servant and I still work. But I'm just so afraid for the wars that's coming behind me.
Finally, Captain Buchanan shared his impressions of the new president with me. He had a surprising take on some of the misinformation that circulated during the campaign.
I think he have the expertise, and I think he has the, with being of, from Africa and a Muslim, and he mentioned that I think that when he talked, they'll listen. I'm hoping they'll listen. Well, I think he said one thing that I really like is that we see it in the South, that any old jackass can kick a barn down, but you need to build one. And I think that's what he just said, that we won't be remembered about what we tore down. We'll be remembered about what we built. And I think that he's an engineer, I think. Well, I think he's on the right track, and I think that he have a lovely family, and I think he loves his wife, and she loves him, and the children. They're just such a beautiful family, and I just wish that, you know, more families would like that, and I think it's genuine, I think that I'll be praying for him, and I'll help him in the way I can, and that I'm willing to do more with less.
As the mall began to empty, throngs of excited spectators headed for the exits and the warmth of indoors. Meanwhile, the enthusiasm remained as giddy children and their parents stuck around, sliding across the icy reflecting pool in front of the Lincoln Memorial. For War News Radio, I'm Daniel Simmons.
This is War News Radio. On January 31st, Iraq will have its first provincial council elections since 2005. Gabriel Ramirez spoke with J.J. Sutherland, a veteran NPR reporter stationed in Baghdad, about how the upcoming elections may shape the country's political landscape.
So, J.J., you've been on the ground for a couple of years now. How important are the upcoming provincial elections for the Iraqis?
I think they're very important. There haven't been elections in Iraq since 2005. And I think a lot of the parties aren't actually sure how much popular support they have. 2005 is a very different time than now, and there's been the Iraqi sectarian civil war, and then the surge and the awakenings and all this other kind of stuff has happened. So no one quite knows how much power they have. I think that the other reason that these are important is this will be the first time that the Iraqi democracy will really be tested, perhaps, in transferring power peacefully from one party to another. For example, a party that is in charge in one province loses control of the provincial council, will they peacefully transfer power to another party? The other reason it's important is that it obviously sets the stage for the national elections coming up this fall, which will determine the shape of the next rulers of the country.
In 2005, many Iraqi Sunnis boycotted the elections because they felt that they lacked legitimacy. How is their participation expected to change in this year's provincial elections?
How it's changed is last election, very, very few Sunnis voted. It was basically a complete boycott. Only one Sunni party, the Iraqi Islamic Party, actually participated in the last elections, which left a lot of Sunnis out in the cold. And I think now, certainly, take Anbar and Diyala, for example, that they feel that since they are going to participate, and they see a chance to get real power through the ballot box rather than through violence, that they are hopeful that there will be quite a bit of change.
How have campaign laws changed since the last election?
I can't really comment on the particulars of the laws. I can certainly say what I've seen in campaigning in the streets. I mean, it seems that every wall in Baghdad is covered with political posters. I was out today with a candidate who's campaigning in the streets in the marketplace, and there's TV debates there. It just sort of seems like, you know, this is a real election, and that it isn't being done in the shadow of so much violence as it was last time.
From your perspective on the ground, how have the approaching elections affected the violence?
Well, there have been some assassinations. At least three candidates have been assassinated over the past few months. But you have to remember that's out of more than 14,000 candidates. The violence here in Iraq is dramatically reduced. Both Iraqi and American officials have been predicting that there will be more violence as the elections approach, but the elections are about a week away, a little over a week away, and there really has not been. It's been very quiet.
From what you've seen, what steps have been taken to ensure the legitimacy of the elections?
Specific steps have taken. Certainly they have. There's the ballot measure. There's a host of counter-fraud measures, from the famous ink that the voters will be dipping their fingers into to watermarks on the ballot to all that kind of stuff. The other thing that they're doing is the security of the polling stations. They're having both police, army, and American forces try to secure those polling stations. They are trying to be very transparent in the counting of the ballot, having representatives from all the different lists at the polling station watching as they count the totals there. They are, you know, really stressing that it's just how important it is, and they're taking it very, very seriously.
Iraqis have been frustrated by the process and outcome of elections in the past. How do you think that Iraqis are feeling about the current elections in comparison to the past elections?
Well, I think the Iraqis I have spoken to do have a certain sense of cynicism about the electoral process, having been disappointed before. But I also think that there is a real sense that maybe this time it will be different, that this time it actually will have an impact, and I think that their expectations are there. It's, you know, I think everyone's sort of waiting to see. I mean, I talked to one young man who said, well, of course the elections are going to be rigged by the politicians. That's what they always do. But I've talked to other people who say, you know what, this is, you know, a chance we're really going to have free and fair elections this time, and we hope for real change and for, you know, that we'll get a good government that will deliver the services we need. So it's very divided, and I think it can sometimes be divided even in the same person, that someone can both be cynical about it but also very hopeful.
That was reporter J.J. Sutherland speaking with War News Radio's Gabriel Ramirez from Baghdad.
This is War News Radio. The recent conflict in the Gaza Strip has raised new questions about the future of diplomatic and military relations in the Middle East. From the inception of Israel until the fall of Saddam Hussein, Iraq involved itself heavily in the Arab-Israeli conflict, believing that the conflict was a central obstacle in the larger movement for Arab unity. Likewise, during this period, Israel viewed Iraq as one of its strongest adversaries. However, the regime change in Iraq has also meant changes in Iraq-Israel relations. Danny Noble has more.
When the State of Israel declared its independence in 1948, five Arab nations attacked what had been the British Mandate of Palestine. Iraq was one of those nations, sending about 5,000 troops to join the fighting. Iraqi attacks on Israeli settlements failed, and the war hurt Iraq's economy. But that didn't stop the country from joining Arab forces in the 1967 Six-Day War against Israel, and then again in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. When the Ba'ath Party took control of Iraq in 1968, it took up the country's search for nuclear weapons. Fearing Iraq's nuclear ambitions combined with its anti-Israel rhetoric, the Israeli Air Force destroyed one of Iraq's nuclear reactors in 1981, an act that was condemned by the UN Security Council. The destruction of the nuclear reactor did discourage attempts at proliferation, but it also underscored Israel's perceived nuclear monopoly in the eyes of the Arab world. This issue continues to be a point of contention in the region. The Ba'ath Party placed a heavy emphasis on Arab nationalism and saw itself as the central leader in the pan-Arabism movement. Furthermore, the Ba'ath Party attempted to paint Arab-Israeli tensions as central to Arab unity, while also trying to use the conflict to advance Iraq's leadership in the Arab world. For these reasons, Iraq's Ba'athist government ensured that Palestinians living in Iraq received benefits, such as free housing and monetary gifts. Many Iraqis, struggling to make ends meet during that time, resented Palestinians because of the privileges they received in Iraq. Between 1965 and 1975, Israel, as well as the United States and several Arab nations, supported the Kurdish rebellion in Iraq. Israel hoped to strengthen its own security by allying with non-Sunni communities, like Iraq's Kurdish North. Israel also saw the Kurdish rebellion as a means of weakening Iraq, one of Israel's most hostile enemies. In the summer of 1990, Iraq invaded and annexed Kuwait, setting in motion the first Gulf War. Israel withheld its troops from fighting alongside the American and Arab forces opposing Saddam Hussein. However, in 1991, Iraq launched Scud missiles at Israel in an unsuccessful effort to draw Israeli forces into the war and thus persuade Arab nations to withdraw from the coalition. The attacks on Israel were fairly inaccurate, but the Israelis did sustain damages. Since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Israeli government seems to have shifted its focus to other hostile nations in the region, such as Iran. Despite Iraq's regime change, Iraqi politicians have not pursued more peaceful relations with Israel. Still, Iraq has stepped back from its place as a prominent regional force opposing Israel. For War News Radio, I'm Danny Noble.
This is War News Radio. The new U.S. administration will likely mean big changes for Iraq and Afghanistan. Right after Barack Obama's election in November, we called up some Iraqis and Afghans to hear their first reactions to the news. War News Radio's Jesse Holler and Anki Jakarta prepared this report. Here's Anki.
Ahmed Rad is an Iraqi engineer from Kut, the capital of the Wasit province on the Iran.
I watched the television and see McKean's speech about Obama victory.
And Rod says Iraq is abuzz with talk of the outcome.
Every people speak about it, in the office, in the street, in my home.
Abdul Rashid Wire of Kabul also followed the election closely.
I was interested to follow who will win. So last night I found that Obama win.
Wire thinks that Obama will bring energy to the American presidency and change to U.S. policy in Afghanistan.
We have a lot of hopes that he will make a lot of changes, especially in the attacks on the terrorism, because in previous times a lot of civilians are killed by the attacks of the coalition forces. So now I think he will make some changes and will draw a new policy.
According to Rod, Obama's victory also resonates with Iraqis on a personal level. While Obama's middle name has been a political liability in the United States, it's reassuringly familiar to many Iraqis.
Some people believe the started Obama because his father, Hussein, is a Muslim name. And most people here in south of Iraq, Shia, have name Hussein.
Rod is anxious to see how change and hope, catchphrases of the Obama-Biden campaign, will translate to the new administration's foreign policy in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The people here in Iraq believe in Obama more than McCain because he believes in he can change the situation in Iraq and the world because the people here don't want death or war again. We want the peace.
For War News Radio, I'm Anki Tigurtha.
This is War News Radio. As part of our series, Afghanistan 101, Emily Hager and Aaron Schwartz tell us how neighboring countries have shaped the conflict in Afghanistan. Here's Aaron.
Afghanistan is a completely landlocked country, bordered by six nations. Iran in the west, then clockwise, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, China, and Pakistan. The longest border, and the one that has most shaped the current war, is with Pakistan in the southeast. This border was negotiated by Great Britain and Afghanistan's first king, Abdul Rahman, in 1893. The border between Pakistan and Afghanistan has become controversial once again, in the wake of the U.S. invasion. When U.S. troops advanced, the border was the line of escape for the Taliban and maybe even Osama bin Laden. Part of the border touches Pakistan's tribal areas, which have never been fully controlled by the central government. These areas are populated mostly by Pashtuns, the ethnic group that formed the core of the Taliban movement. With U.S. pressure and billions of U.S. dollars, the Pakistani army has been trying to crack down on al-Qaeda and supporters in the area throughout the war. President Pervez Musharraf faced two assassination attempts because of this action, but some U.S. politicians have still criticized him for not doing enough. And President Musharraf's recent declaration of emergency rule complicates things even more for the U.S. Pakistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan have been the only bordering nations that have allowed U.S. forces to use bases in their countries. But in 2005, the U.S. withheld some economic support from Uzbekistan in response to a bloody protest there and a lack of political and economic reforms. The Uzbek government responded by kicking the U.S. off their bases and roads. That decision has forced the U.S. to rely more on Musharraf and bases in Pakistan. Afghanistan's neighbors are also key players in non-military aspects of the war. Millions of Afghan refugees have fled to neighboring countries because of the violence that has plagued the country for the last 30 years. When U.S. forces arrived in 2001, they began pouring back, excited by the prospect of a more stable and peaceful Afghanistan. But 3 million refugees remain abroad, mostly in camps and cities in Pakistan and Iran. Over the last several years, these governments have said they can't support so many refugees and have begun programs to forcibly remove them. The efforts have been controversial, as some Afghans have spent decades in those countries, and the Afghan government says it doesn't have the resources to reabsorb them. Afghanistan's ability to deal with cross-border issues, like refugees, drugs, and militant activities, will be crucial to the long-term stability of the region. For War News Radio, I'm Aaron Schwartz.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
And check out the new feedback link on our website. We want to hear from you, so now's the perfect time to send us that comment you've been holding off on, or that suggestion you've always wished we'd take. Leave us a word or two. Remember, that's warnewsradio.org.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Madeline Abramowitz, Jess Engebretson, Meredith Firetog, Elizabeth Hippel, Calvin Ho, Jesse Hoff,
Kevin Kim, Clara Cabeza, Lauren Pachivici, Elizabeth Throckheld, Jenna Zhu, and Abdullah Mazin. I'm Emily Hager.
And I'm Hanzi Lo Wong. Until next time, thanks for listening.